The end of this year's Transmission of Light Assembly. Jeffrey asked a question this morning about freedom, because that's actually what the Transmission of Light is about. I wouldn't necessarily say that the light is freedom, but freedom is an essential quality of the light. So we could say that there are two kinds of freedom: freedom from and freedom to. Freedom from the bondage to all our attachments. Some might say that's freedom. Freedom from all attachments means all attachments are no longer. Some might say freedom from attachments means freedom in the midst of attachments. Standing in the storm of the eight winds of the world, the winds of pleasant and unpleasant, of gain and loss, of praise and blame, of fame and disgrace, and just not be moved by them, blow as they may. Freedom from. In this sense, we could say that freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Everything's been let go of. It's gone. We've lost all grip on all of those things which have a grip on us. And nothing ain't worth nothing. I would say, and it's free. Not really, but it's free. There's nothing left to lose. We're just here. That nothing that we have, that we're left with, it ain't worth nothing. It's just a poor wayfarer with nothing left, and that nothing is free. So sometimes nirvana is loosely translated as freedom from suffering, freedom from needing anything to be different than it is, liberation, emancipation. I recently came across a story of a modern day Theravada monk, where, you know, all these hundreds of precepts and austere practices that tradition takes up more than any other Buddhist tradition in general these days. He said, people think that, you know, having 227 precepts is like a complete restriction of freedom. And, you know, in the conventional sense, it is. There's so many things, their life is so narrow, so many things they can't do. You know, can't have a family, can't shop, can't even use, you know, engage in commerce, can't even eat anything unless it's like placed in their hands. They can't even pick it up off the table. It's like being handcuffed. It's right there in front of me, but no, it has to be like handed hand to hand. If those keep the Vinaya very literally, which some do, it's like the ultimate, you could say the ultimate lack of freedom. Everything is, every move in your entire life is completely limited. And he says, so people think of it as like, it looks like, you know, much worse than prison. And he says, but the secret is, when you're doing it, it's like the greatest freedom ever. I mean, that was his experience anyway. We've been a monk for 30 years or so. He's like, for that very reason, because we don't have to engage in all of our habitual tendencies, and then everything becomes very, very simple, and there's this great internal freedom. Maybe you could say externally it looks totally not free. Internally, there's this great ease of like nothing is necessary to do. In our tradition, that's pretty extreme, but I thought that was interesting that he spoke of it as a sense of deep freedom that looks just the opposite. So it's like freedom from all the things that we're stuck to. And then there's freedom too. And in that case, you know, such a Vinaya monk might not have this other kind as much. They might say that they do within the narrow confines. They're free too. And I see free too as like free to live and free to express spontaneously whatever arises according to conditions in the moment. So, anything is possible. And I think that's a lot we hear in these Zen stories is we see that kind of freedom. We could even say that freedom too arises naturally from the freedom from, right? When we're not bound by all the habitual constrictions, then spontaneity can come forth. And maybe part of freedom too is even the freedom to make mistakes, and that's okay. Or as we were speaking about this morning, these two aspects of the big self of the light are the essence and the function, the emperor of the universe, you could say, is kind of like a freedom from any any limitations. And the emissaries, the generals, have the freedom to what did he say, like protect the byways or something, the freedom to act, the function that comes along with the essence. The general who commands the strategic pass. We could also talk about skillful means, the freedom to respond in skillful ways, coming from one's intention arising from the light, skillful means that might look strange sometimes. Like the Buddha could actually say in the Lotus Sutra, right? If you kids come out of that burning house now and stop playing with your toys, I'll give you like the best toy carts you've ever seen, much better than the toys you have in there. Donkey carts and sheep carts and goat carts and aardvark carts. And then when they come out, they, it's like, well, you know, actually, there aren't all those carts. But I was free to stretch the truth a little bit to help you, save you from the fire. Anything more about freedom? In the early sutras, we hear that phrase, you know, done is what had to be done. Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly, I think it's Basho, I'm not sure, either Basho, who in a century before Hakuin had to work very hard, had the bad tuberculosis.
Mm. Basui.
Stood up against the wall.
You know, that is, we do have the tradition of done is what had to be done. I think, how does it go in the Pali Canon over and over? Like, he accomplished the task for which people go forth from their narrow life and practice for this purpose, and he accomplished the purpose. But we also have in our family style the practice of going beyond Buddha, which is kind of like there's no completion. So, or you could say there is completion, but the completion is called going beyond the current Buddha. So it's complete when it goes beyond this Buddha, it's complete, and then it goes beyond completion. We could say completion beyond completion. Beyond completion. Beyond completion. So no end. I think those stories are nice to remind us that to not be complacent. We always have to, if we feel like, Maybe none of us have that problem that we feel like we're finished. We don't have to worry about that so much. But if that ever happened, to be open to there's further.
been our aim for over a year now, and the third journey. And so I've come to see freedom in four stages. Well, three initial stages, and then fourth, I think. The first one is I get to be emancipated from suffering. And the second one with the Mahaprajna practices, it's the I who is free from suffering is actually just a transient manifestation. The third journey with mind only, Yogacara, is, but even though there is no particular manifestation of myself, all that manifests is myself. And then there's, I think, the fourth, which is, I think, the part that raises my Treya, which is the complete dissolution of this light into the details of sentient beings, which is kind of inexpressible. You can't thematize that. You just literally have to do it. But at that point, everything gets dropped off. There's no tradition, no lineage, no nothing like that. And it's probably happening, and it's never seen except as an appropriate response.
Are there thoughts about freedom?
It's a relatively new area of neuroscience. They're studying how people, the neuroscience of how people make choices. And apparently we have a finite amount of energy. We have lots of different types of energies, but we have a finite amount of energy to make choices. And after we use that up on a daily or weekly basis, then our tendency to make random and poor choices greatly increases. We have finite energy, a finite tolerance for making choices. We face a gazillion choices every single day. Some of them are very small. Most of them are fairly small.
It almost sounds like attention span, or like we, because I think there is this effect that we're paying attention, and then as we get tired, our choices tend to not be as good.
So I think this speaks to freedom from choice. The Theravada Bhikkhu may initially seem like he or she is very restrictive, but from that restriction, I suppose they receive much energy. They have that. They are free from having to make choices and are therefore free to practice a lot.
Yeah, and I think we could say, maybe even go so far as to say, Sashin is designed for this purpose. Sashin obviously is a huge restriction on freedom, and it's all designed to bring forth this true freedom. And I think we all experience that, you know, in our own way. Maybe just a little way, maybe a bigger way. And I think it's the degree to which we give up our choice like that. It seems to be, in my experience, often correlated with the freedom that comes from it. sessions for me where, because there's been a lot of range, where I've really just decided, like, I like basically not leave the zendo right after break, you know, come right back in and, you know, not talk to anyone and you know, limit all possibilities of anything extra. Those have often been for me. I don't want to say it's some inherent correlation, but those are the ones tends to be where the freedom really starts to overflow, the internal sense of release. Interestingly, it's been a concern for me. Like this sesshin, you know, I'm so used to doing them where it's kind of like everyone's staying in the same place, so that already creates a whole different thing. But this sesshin in particular, there are lots of coming and going, but particularly kind of like people have committed to certain parts. Commitments, I think, are big restrictions to freedom, right? And then it's like, well, stuff comes up, right? It's like, does stuff not come up when we're all living in the same place? I think it does, but we don't notice it maybe because the phone's off the hook, the internet's down, we don't see people outside of sesshin. You know, like Tassahar, basically like a family member has to basically die before, you know, you can actually leave the valley. So it's such a different situation here. But I wonder, how can we create, because it's hard to create that. How do you create this, like, total limitation on freedom to, in order to create this, like, real letting go in all the corners and recesses? It's an open question for me. If people have ideas, please, I'll offer them. Yes.
I think, in sesshin, like the bhikkhu, we have to choose to intend to do it every day, every moment of every day. Right? I mean, we in sesshin have the same choices as everybody else. Like we can go get coffee, we can go home, we can do whatever we want. Nothing is actually stopping us. We're not going to get arrested. We're not going to have somebody run over a bouncer. We're not going to be physically restrained. Yeah.
Some sesshins, they do have bouncers. But the Eno and I are, we're kind of pushovers.
So we do have this freedom, but we choose to intend to have this intention to create a sesshin container together. Second actors.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard. Almost like, I think I remember saying early some past year here about that. I think it was when we were trying the experiment of what we called informal sesshin. We just did the first year I arrived, which means we had a schedule, but like anybody could just do anything they wanted. There'd be like, you know, bells and stuff into time periods, but you know, you could just drop in and out at will, and people did. Sometimes the zendo was empty. I'd just be sitting in here alone. And but in some ways it was very simple because we didn't have meals, right? Because you can't really do, I think you couldn't really have orioki meals because you wouldn't know how many people were going to be here. So bring your own food, come when you want, and I recall, as we're speaking about it now, that I think I said something like, this is a mature person sesshin. Because there are no rules, basically. Just like you said, you have to create it. Each person has to find their own way. And cause and effect holds true. So if you, you know, tap in for 10 minutes of one period or something, that has one effect. If you never miss, that has another effect. But it's kind of like up to us. So in a way, it's like, that's the freedom too. So I was thinking earlier about, like, you know, the freedom from being bound by our attachments, kind of like manifest the freedom to come forth spontaneously. But in some ways, the opposite is also true. The way we practice with the freedom to, and studying that situation, can actually lead to the freedom from attachments. Mm-hmm.
A couple of things come to mind. Just first of all, the distinction in the Buddhism of the elders, the goal of the Arhat, and the extinguishing of the passions and the blowing out of the temple is nirvana. I recall a small book, which the last kind of children's book, and the last picture was of the monk Bhikkhu watching his ex-wife having intercourse and being totally free of any passions because he had extinguished everything. And in contrast that to say Soto Zen practice as I have experienced it, where, as Norman Fisher says, freedom from suffering is the freedom to suffer. In other words, to continue to have all of these emotions and feelings and experiences and to suffer with them. Somehow, in a way that I'm not entirely clear of, to not be bound by it. But in a more substantial point for me, it's one thing to be free in the structured confines of sesshin or formal practice. But how about when you have three or four kids and not enough money coming in, and one of them's sick, or you've just had a diagnosis of cancer, or you yourself are in the hospital with serious conditions, or actually facing our own death rather than thinking about it, or becoming free in those circumstances is a hell of a lot more difficult than becoming free within the structure of this practice.
So you could say,
it seems to me that that's the goal, to be free under all conditions.
Yes. That's the goal. And you could say sesshin is all for that. It's all for those reasons. It's a contrived, limited little thing we set up as humans, kind of an artificial, experimental ground, where we can really work with that in order to, of course, then we leave sesshin, which will happen very soon. then we have to face all of that. And old age, sickness, death, it's coming to all of us without exception. And it will be difficult. But I have deep faith that this kind of practice really does apply to those situations. The more we can deeply, and daily zazen, of course, too, is a kind of letting go and freedom, but sesshin practice just goes these levels deeper. Like I was talking about this, this wonderful place, an interesting place to work with pain, physical pain, and the way that the mind is defining pain, how they're not quite linked. There's no inherent linkage like that, If I can remember that, and maybe it takes doing it a lot at the time of when the great pains of the future come, I will be very grateful for sesshin. Physical pain and emotional pain. In a way, sesshin, it's a funny thing that we even ever come to such an event because it's painful, which is why it's very easy to weave in and out of it. It's not comfortable. And yet, so like this thing with pain, like I probably won't get to check this particular little Dharma gate out until the next session, because I could, but chances are highly unlikely that I will, because I'm not going to like be willing, except in this unique container, to like sit here with this much pain and just really bore into exploring what it is. So, and it's together that we, you know, like I could do it, but I do it actually with the support of all of you. That's the beauty of Sesshin. Yes.
Back in 2002, when my house of cards collapsed, it was so traumatic, I thought, that I meditated to stop my work, and I did. But since then, by practicing, in a sense, the Sesshin is a simulated death watch. By practicing, when I got my cancer diagnosis, it was just another feature of that day. And my treatment was just another day with features. Staying with that particular moment, with the difficulties I had, and I still have them. Some of us have these difficulties ongoing. But you know, the process of dealing with it is not substantially different than what happens when I stub my toe. So I think there's something to willingly entering into the simulation of death as the full view of impermanence. Taking the full view of things arising and then being replaced by the next thing arising. And I think the benefit is that instead of having to wait for the big catastrophic house of cards to fall and saying, oh my God, can I handle this? It's something I can do 1,000 times a day. And that trains me to take really big deals, is what they are, no big deals. That's tremendously liberating. Tremendously liberating. And I found all these turnings to be, I don't know, the next things to do. Because I got very caught up in, oh, I'm free from my suffering. And much into, look how great I am, I'm free from my suffering. And so coming through these different phases has been important. And I do think that it's not over till it's over. There's going to be one time when that feature is the last feature. But it's just a feature.
It's not over till it's over. Therefore, even if you look like a monk and half-heartedly join in the Zen community, if you've not clarified this matter, you're just struggling pointlessly without any results. Even less can either beginners or veterans in these corrupt times of the last days of the Dharma study thoroughly if their spirits waver, even if they try to model their mental states and physical deportment after former enlightened ones. So you may have heard about Mapo, the degenerate Dharma, the age of decline, which was one of those old teachings that people used, I think, as a skillful means. It was just, you know, some old sutras say the time passing since Shakyamuni, Buddha's passage, there are these phases where there's the counterfeit Dharma where it looks like the real thing, and then there's we're now, according to various calculations, even Dogen's time, they were just beginning what they called the age of decline, and we could see it as another wacky Dharma myth, but it's just interesting to see how different people responded to that teaching. For example, in Dogen's time, the Pure Land School of Shinran was completely based on this teaching. Since it's the age of decline, no one will be able to really practice anymore. People's bodhicitta is too weak. It's impossible to ever realize the way. Therefore, all we can do is rely on Amitabha Buddha. But the Zen schools, at least Dogen, he would sometimes talk about the age of decline in that Likaizan is here in the sense of kind of like spurring people on. Like, it's going to be even harder to practice now. That's why it's hard for you. So you have to practice all the more wholeheartedly because of this age. But Dogen at one point says the age of decline and the true Dharma age are not some fixed things. They're like just according to your intentions. You make the age of decline. You make the true Dharma through your own practice. So don't think it's something outside yourself. But here, Keizan picks it up in the kind of like old way. Monks these days are not stable in their conduct and do not thoroughly learn the major and minor forms of deportment and the internal and external mental arts. So it looks as if there is no monastic deportment. They're coming and going from sesshin all the time. Even if mental states and physical deportment are like those of antiquity, if you have not clarified the realm of mind, these are no more than the defiled state of humans and celestials. How much more do people who do not clarify the realm of mind or control physical deportment receive the offerings of the faithful in vain and fall into the hells? Remember, he's talking to monks need more stern admonition because they're getting a free lunch already. So, there's people working to support them. So, of all people, their only job is to practice. So, they better be on the ball. Thus, a former worthy said, "The world has deteriorated and people are lax. Even if one's mental states and physical deportment are not like those of the ancient holy ones, if one is able to clarify the one great matter thoroughly and intimately, perhaps one will not differ from all the Buddhas of the three times." So here's the other side. He's kind of criticizing monastic deportment and so on, but then he says, some former worthy said, "Well, even if you do come and go from sesshin, if you're able to clarify the one great matter, perhaps one will not differ from all the Buddhas of the three times." It's not a fixed thing. It's not like if you don't keep all the minutiae of the precepts and guidelines, then there's no way to be Buddha. Obviously, these things are set up for a purpose, but in the Mahayana, nothing is fixed. Anything is possible, any moment. Alleluia. Yes.
My question is related to what you just said and what you brought up, which is this. I'm really having trouble with this. What sounds like a line that you have to cross. You cross the line, and then you cross the line. Right?
Oh, the enlightenment line. Yeah.
Helpful to me, and so not in my experience. It doesn't encourage me as a practitioner. It doesn't encourage.
Why would you say it?
More vigorous to think, you know, that all the moments that arise of clarity, and then next moment, you know, is whatever it is. It just confuses me. Like, so those who have clarified the great matter are Buddhists?
I think that it could be implied. And maybe that's impossible. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big topic in the Buddhist tradition worthy of much further discussion, because it is part of the original Buddhist tradition, both early teachings, we're talking about now kind of scriptural Indian teachings. Theravada has its own system of steps and stages, particular lines of realization that are defined very precisely. They're not just like fancy names with no description. They're actually, the interesting thing is that they're defined by what's lost. They're defined by the absence of certain afflictions rather than some great thing that you get. So it's more like the final freedom is just another word for there's nothing left to lose. And then the Mahayana, there's the 10 Bodhisattva Bhumis, so they're even more exalted in particular stages of practice. So then we have Zen, you know, is born out of that Indian tradition, and for the most part goes beyond. Maybe Zen more than any other tradition. We have actual, you know, koans about, like, how can I avoid falling into stages? Like, I don't want to fall into stages of realization here. So it's unique in that way, and particularly Soto Zen. Now, Rinzai Zen, you know, and I know you have a background in Rinzai, there's a little more stage thing going on just with this, you know, Kensho as a particular event and a particular time and place with particular, maybe some particular irreversibilities. I think often my understanding is it could be from the descriptions of these, maybe it's not officially, but could be correlated in many ways with like what we call like in the Mahayana, the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, or in Theravada, stream entry. In terms of like, yeah, that's not maybe necessarily stages of realization. Although I don't know, what would Nettie say? Stages of practice.
I remember when my first teacher described it that, you know, there is this, can be really motivating, this idea that you can have a profound, sudden dropping away of body and mind. That could be really motivating. So let's say that happens. Then she would describe it, it's like, okay, so you've got this flame, and it's got a glass, it's in a lamp. And then the rest of the koan curriculum, if you like, or rest of your life, is just keeping the glass clean, like just keeping it clean. And if you don't, well, doesn't that enlightenment experience is complete waste.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes silly and dark. And, well, that's kind of like a real tragedy. So it's not... The way I experience it is not so much like stages as you have an experience and then you're just polishing from that moment on. You're just refining and clarifying deeper the depth on and on.
Although you might say that experience is the one kind of like a stage.
And then in Hakkawan, traditional koans, there are stages. The first introductory koans are designed to have the experience of dissolving the self. And then each set of koans along the curriculum does have a particular function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in Soto Zen, the five ranks or positions of Dungshan and Saoshan.
Besides that distinction between Rinzai and Soto, is how about the earlier Zen, the first five patriarchs before it split into schools? That seemed to be a little different approach to me. From Bodhidharma through the fifth patriarch.
In terms of stages?
In terms of kind of the emphasis on what realization was, on this question of, you know, Soto seems, you know, practice is realization, and realization is practice, and, Rinzai had his formal, from my experience with the Rinzai Myo Sinji lineage, and Hakkalinness system, which would lead to eventually a deeper and deeper understanding, and there could be, according to Hakkalin, many, many small kensho's, small sitaris, and, you know, and
big ones.
Great,
yeah.
Ones even.
Yeah, Hakkalin was into that.
And then Bodhidharma's and the first five patriarchs, and then the flavor is different to me. I thought you may understand that better than I do, the separation into the schools, but...
Early Chinese Zen does have a different flavor, but I think it's always pointing towards, like you mentioned Huang Bo earlier, about just cease conceptual thought and you will be Buddha, right? Over and over he says.
So we get together and talk our butts off and theorize like crazy and conceptualize like crazy. And not just we, but... Norman's group,
yeah.
And his seminars.
Yeah, and
the Rinzai people, when they're, you know, by themselves, do the same thing.
Yeah.
They may not.
Yeah. And Huang Bo does it in order to say that too, right? So, and to write a whole book of his recorded sayings. So, we have to clarify, what does it mean to cease conceptual thought? It's not being like a rock or a stump, right? It's not like a stagnant pond where no dragons like to play. So, there's subtle things. But I just think this point about stages is interesting, that Nanette brought it up as that it's not encouraging. And Netty's teacher said it's taught to be encouraging. So I think for different people it could be, have different, so that's why we have all these different traditions, and people are drawn to different ones according to their inclinations. I think that really stage-oriented people probably won't end up like for their whole life in just like classic Soto Zen. I think I would venture to say that. Although I'm personally have been interested in stages in my life, and I'm still hanging around the Soto halls.
So.
Yeah, there's all these things going on in this amazing world, back and forth, thinking it's over there, over here, and I think it's, yeah, very natural, and the whole thing of setting up stages, you could say, the whole thing is this amazing play of skillful means in order to help some people practice more diligently, in order to get some people really hooked on it, just so that they see in the end that you can't really say it's like this. So all of that is, you know, stages is dangerous stuff, I think, in some ways, because for a practitioner, stages of realization are like the juiciest thing ever, right? It's like, talk about like something to generate grasping, especially if you're like sitting in sesshin and you're not getting very much good food and you're not getting very much good sleep and not getting anything comfortable. Well, at least can you get the big one? So, and then the problem is that then we set it up as some something outside yourself. So Keizan, although he does kind of, you must reach this realm, he's also constantly saying, you're not going to get this from anyone or anything outside yourself. And it's not apart from who you are right now. Everybody's fully endowed with it.
And you're part of the answer because the question that follows, you've got to get this realm.
This.
What is this realm?
Yeah. Yeah.
This realm he's talking about that you've got to get.
This realm. Nothing lacking, nothing extra. The slightest hair of making it into this, that, or not this, or not that, we're lost in confusion. But when the server comes with the rice, we bow. Keizan is rolling around in laughter at us. Here, let me go on a little bit more. Oh, in fact, Arsashin, this time around is coming to a close. I'll just finish Keizan's words. And of course, this conversation will never end. We vow from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma. From the beginning, there has been no triple world to escape, much less six paths to be traveled. Therefore, investigate thoroughly and study meticulously. Clarify the business beneath the patch robe. This one great matter has nothing to do with the three periods of Dharma, the true Dharma and age of decline. Now we're hearing, it's got nothing to do with any of this. Or differences between India, China, and Japan. Do not be sad about living in the evil time of the last days of the Dharma, or hate being a resident of a peripheral land far away from India and China. Do some of you hate how far away you are from India? I sometimes do. Of course, even if any number of Buddhas came and tried to offer you this one great matter, even their power would not suffice in the end. Therefore, this is not a path you can pass on to your children, or a path you can receive from your father. You have to do it yourself, awaken to it yourself, and acquire it yourself. Even though you practice for infinite eons, self-authentication, or self-verification, and self-awakening, or self-satori, happen in an instant. Instantly, he's interesting to me that he's emphasizing self-verification, because he also strongly emphasizes verification from the teacher, but here he's saying this has nothing to do with anyone else. Once you rouse yourself, not so much as a hair in all of heaven and earth will get in the way. Once you reach this realm, nothing is hidden in the whole of eternity. How can there be anything to receive from Buddhas? If you want to reach this realm completely, there's only one thing you have to do. Do you think it's very complicated? Right now, you must first abandon everything. And then If there's something else to lose, lose it. You must not even seek the realm of Buddhas and ancestors. Much less can there be any attachment or loathing of self or others. Just look directly within without a hair of intellectualizing. There's without doubt something that has no skin or flesh. Its body is like space without any specific form. It's like pure water which is clear to the bottom, completely clear and bright. You just have to know it thoroughly. Now, how can I reveal this principle? The water is clear to the very bottom. It gleams naturally without need of cutting and polishing. Or the pearl gleams naturally without need of cutting and polishing. In the end, it's the same as it ever was. Another session comes to a close. Is this the realm of Buddhas or Maras? Let's go home and see what will happen next. We dedicate any positive energy arising from this wholehearted devotion to the moment we call Sesshin, to the complete awakening of all living beings. May they be free from all suffering and distress, and free to come and go as they wish, following the clouds and wind. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.